It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, a Brown County Farmers Market project aims to teach jobs and business skills to teens. We'll find out how that works. First, a UW-Madison student who has a past record of setting fire to predominantly African-American churches recently caused a stir on campus. 33-year-old Daniel Dropick is recruiting on campus for a local chapter of the pro-white group, the American Freedom Party. That group, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, is a political party with deep ties to white supremacism. In an interview with the Associated Press, Dropick said that courses examining white and male privilege and his frustration with the Black Lives Matter movement on campus led him to start a local chapter of the group. He released an audio statement on the Madison American Freedom Party website today. He said he regrets his past attacks and that he does not want to do anyone harm by creating the new group on campus.
The important thing to remember is that me as an individual, in spite of my past, and that my activities with this club right now, that neither one of these are centered around racial hatred or a desire to do harm to other people based on their racial and ethnic backgrounds. And while I have at some times been a critic of Chancellor Rebecca Blank, she is correct to state that there is no worries about any kind of harm coming from me or any group that I have authority over.
That was a clip of a statement that Dropick posted earlier today. Noah Habenstreit is the associate news editor at the Daily Cardinal, a student newspaper serving the UW-Madison community. He talked to us earlier today about reactions to Dropick's efforts. Noah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, start us off. When did Daniel Dropick's efforts to create this new campus group start to cause some stir?
So this was a couple days ago. There was someone, we didn't know it was Daniel Dropick at the time, but there was someone handing out flyers advertising a, quote, alt-right group on campus. He was handing out flyers to people. It said to combat anti-white racism, which obviously caused somewhat of a stir on campus. People took to Facebook to respond to that.
And he's promoting a group, the national organization called the American Freedom Party. What do we know about that organization?
Well, you might have seen in Chancellor Blank's statement from yesterday, she called the American Freedom Party a recognized hate group, which people consider it to be.
And what have we seen so far as an effort? That statement from the chancellor made it clear this is not a recognized student group. As far as she could tell, it sounds like it was one person.
Right. And it was one person. And Daniel Dropick did get back to me in an email. He said that he'd had some responses since he was handing out the flyers. He told me that there were 10 to 12 people who had expressed interest in the club.
And how has he been describing in these handouts and what he has said to you and other media about the goals of this organization?
Yeah, he told me that the goal is to combat the liberalism of UW-Madison. Interestingly, besides the thing about combating anti-white racism, he's not focusing so much on race so much on his website, but he considers himself an arch-conservative and an alt-right person.
And talk about some of the reaction we've seen. You said people took to Facebook. What are you seeing from students and in the statement from the chancellor?
Yeah, students have been coming out overwhelmingly against this organization. I mean, people have been very active in expressing their disbelief that this would be on our campus on Facebook, taking to other forms of social media. And people have just been talking about this on campus as well. It's caused quite a stir.
And this story took on a new wrinkle with some information about the student's background. Past conviction record? Can you talk about that?
That's right. There was some murmuring around campus that Daniel Dropick had committed two racial crimes. He'd burned two predominantly black churches, and we didn't know that it was the same Daniel Dropick for sure until we found some proof on the internet there and we were able to report on that. People found that to be very concerning.
And how has he addressed that information coming out?
Well, after we put out our article about this and Chancellor Blank put out her statement denouncing his group, he took to his website to make a statement. He actually had an audio statement on his website where he said that he did commit these crimes. He admitted to the crimes, and he said that he was very sorry. Among other things, he said that while he was in prison for about 5 years, he had he'd gotten to know many different types of people, and he was no longer the racist that he once was.
We're talking to Noah Habenstreit. He's with the Daily Cardinal, a student newspaper serving the UW-Madison community, about efforts by a student on the UW-Madison campus to recruit people to the American Freedom Party. You also spoke, Noah, with some members of conservative groups, other conservative groups on the UW-Madison campus. Sounds like they want to keep him at arm's length at the minimum.
That's right. I spoke to Kara Bell, who's the chair of Young Americans for Freedom, which is a conservative group on campus and around the country. And even before the Dropix history came to light, she said that she wanted nothing to do with him. She said that he had reached out to her to try and get them to work together, and she made clear to him that they had no similarities. That's what she told me. And after she heard about his past last night, I talked to her this morning, and she said that it was outrageous and that she doesn't even consider Daniel Dropix to be a conservative. She says he's just an extremist.
Getting back to Chancellor Blank's statement we touched on earlier, she had talked about freedom of speech on campus and whether the university should be policing people based on past criminal records. What kind of things did she say about that in the statement?
She said that they were going to look into their policy on criminal background checks for students trying to get into the university. Right now, there are no background checks, so someone like Daniel Dropix could get into the university without any background check.
And some of the reaction around that issue has been, well, maybe we shouldn't be looking at criminal background checks. It sounds like that could exclude people from university based on a criminal record that they may have put behind them, whether we're talking about Daniel Dropix or any potential student.
Some students have already voiced concern that if we look into that policy and if we look at criminal background in terms of letting people into the school, some people say that that will disproportionately affect racial minorities who may be more likely to have spent time in prison.
This has gotten some national attention. This comes at a time where there have been concerns about racially related incidents on campus. The student at a football game, or the person, I should say, at a football game, dressed as Barack Obama with a noose. Legislators concerned about a problems of whiteness class. Are you seeing this from where you're sitting as a tense time when it comes to race and politics on campus?
Well, certainly some people on campus see it that way. And last night or early this morning, three members of Associated Students of Madison, which is our student government organization here, put out a statement, and they denounced Chancellor Blank's statement about Daniel Dropix, saying it didn't go far enough. So they're certainly not happy with Chancellor Blank's response to racist incidents on this campus.
So as things go on, there's still Daniel Dropix is still a student, presumably still recruiting for this organization. What are you watching for next?
Well, yes, as far as we know, he's still recruiting. In his audio statement last night, he said that he urges people to not just consider his past, but that this is still a valid organization in his mind. So I'm not sure what to expect next, but we'll see if he remains a prominent member of the campus community.
Noah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Noah Habenstreit. He's the associate news editor at the Daily Cardinal, a student newspaper serving the UW-Madison community. He joined us earlier today to talk about reactions to efforts to create a pro-white group on the campus by a student who was previously convicted of racially motivated arson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's Food Friday. Our guest has a lot of advice on cooking with eggs and recipes for the classics and some exciting new twists. Right now, teens and tweens in Brown County had a unique opportunity last summer to gain some job and business skills by running their own farmers market stands. UW Extension in Brown County teamed up with the Boys and Girls Club of Green Bay for the market program, hoping to raise food and raise the next generation of entrepreneurs. Margaret Franchino joins us now from our studio in Green Bay. She's the Community Garden Coordinator for UW Extension Brown County. Margaret, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with a problem you were trying to help solve with this program, a decline in teen summer employment. What's been happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So in recent years, we've seen really a decline in the number of teens who have summer jobs. And just overall, there's such an advantage to work experience. We found there's a lot of research showing that teens who have work experience as young adults really succeed more later on in life. And so we want to be able to address that problem and kind of fill a gap by having a program giving teens work experience.
And it's not just hoping to train people to have jobs in the future, as I understand it. You're also responding to some local planning studies saying, hey, we need not just workers, but future entrepreneurs in Brown County.
Yes. So the 2011 Life Study is a well-known study in this part of the county. And they identified growing entrepreneurs as one of the top priorities, different county leaders did. And so we're really excited to be able to help with that with the Teen Market Program.
Let's get our hands dirty and talk about what the kids actually did in this program. It started in part with having their own garden plots, right?
Yes. So they had their own garden plot and they were completely responsible for it. So they planted and then throughout the summer had to weed, water, take care of it, and then eventually harvest at the end of the summer. So it was great hands-on experience for them.
And is this through the UW Extension Community Gardens that you work with?
Yes. So they had some gardens on site, and then also we have a community garden about a half mile down the road from the Boys and Girls Club, so they could just walk down and tend to that garden as well.
And are these kids who grew up with gardens or farms, or was this new to a lot of them?
You know, it really depended on the kid. There are some that had some experience, but there are some it was completely new for. And so it was great that they actually got to have the hands-on experience. It really connects them to their food to have the experience of growing it.
And then through the summer, as I understand it, they weren't just doing this gardening. They did a lot of, market research in a way. What kind of stuff did they do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we tried to kind of make it really multifaceted, have a lot of different experiences drawn in. Different things we did. We went on field trips. So they went to the downtown Green Bay farmers market, and then they used that experience to interview vendors at the farmers market to kind of gain their experience to use in their own experience having their own farmers market stall. They also went to a local CSA, the Twin Elms Gardens. They went and toured there as well to see another aspect of production. And then they also had some different classes from different experts who came in. So UW Extension horticulture expert educator came in and did a horticulture lesson. We had a financial planning lesson from a different Extension employee. So we really tried to make it multifaceted, have lots of different experiences come in. And then also they did some of their own research and planning for the program. So they researched, you know, what tent and what coolers and what supplies should we buy, things like that. So it really gave them a wide variety of opportunities and experiences.
It sounds like a degree in a business school with a market, a garden on the side.
Yes.
So how did the kids take to this? Was this something, having the actual hands-on part of it, did that make the learning part of it more fun?
I think so, yes. I think we did surveys at the end and we had reports throughout, and what we heard over and over again was that the hands-on experience was really the part that mattered to the kids and really the part that made them want to come back and do more over and over.
Now let's talk about the kids themselves. Who was participating in this program?
Mm-hmm. So it was participants at the Boys and Girls Club, members there. So we mostly worked with the tween population, so kind of average age of 11, 12-ish. So probably too young to get a summer job themselves, so not an older teen, but old enough to be able to gain that job experience and really be able to apply that in a few years down the road.
And was this last summer the first time you've done this?
It was. It was our pilot year last year. So we're planning on doing it again in 2017, but definitely applying some lessons that we learned in 2016.
How many kids were on board the first time around?
Yeah, it depended on the week. With summer, it's hard with scheduling, things like that. But between 5 and 10 usually per week came to the program.
Yeah, and what were some of the lessons you learned from the pilot program?
Yeah, so one thing that we kind of struggled with, which I'm sure every gardening program struggles with, is the weather. It was kind of against us this year. We had, I think, 12 different dates that we met, and 8 of them it rained. So we had to struggle with that a little bit. Besides that, I think working with kids in the summer, just trying to keep things fun and lively, you know, not have kind of the traditional classroom experience, but more being out hands-on, I think was really a good experience for them.
Now, they were doing the garden. They were maintaining this garden throughout the summer. The grand finale, it sounds like, was they actually Did they go to an existing farmer's market, or did they kind of run their own farmer's market?
They ran their own farmer's market.
Okay.
So we talked with the Boys and Girls Club, our partner in this, and they thought that having it on site would be a great opportunity. So we had a tent set up in front of the Boys and Girls Club, and then they were able to sell to parents and people passing by. So it was great that they got to show parents what they'd been working on all summer and then other people in the community as well.
And what kind of produce was available here that the kids grew?
All different. Just kind of the typical tomatoes, beans, cucumbers, onions, lettuce, all different things. We had a good season, so they got a lot of produce out.
Margaret Franchino is with us. She's the Community Garden Coordinator for the University of Wisconsin Extension, Brown County, talking about a program. It was a pilot last year, coming back next year. Kids 11 and 12 years old grew their own crops, their own garden, and ended up holding their own farmer's market, got a lot of business advice along the way. So, Margaret, let's talk about lessons learned by the kids. What kind of skills did you see them taking out of this?
Yeah, so really a wide range of skills. We focused on nutrition in some lessons. So we talked about, how do you read a food label? How do you make a healthy snack? Things like that. Also business skills. We had them interview different vendors at the farmers market and then kind of get skills on how to relate to customers, how to advertise. A couple of them got to be on the news advertising the market, so that was a great experience for them. Besides that, horticulture skills, the hands-on growing your own food, that's something you can carry with you throughout life, which is wonderful. Some financial management skills, when we had an extension educator come in and talk about that. So really a wide range there.
Are you looking to make it bigger next summer?
That's the goal. With programming this year, we only met once a week, and our goal is to do twice a week this year. Just we found that it was hard to squeeze everything in the lessons and then also tending to the garden. So we're hoping that. One other thing we're hoping to do this year is add a salsa-making component, so just kind of bringing it to the next level to selling the produce and then also preparing the produce and selling that as well.
And kind of teaching the whole value-added concept to the kids along
Correct.
The way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, we're in January. You may have noticed up there, about as far away as we can get from gardening season. But what kind of planning is going on for your community garden there in general right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So we actually send out our community garden registration packets in February to see who's coming back from year to year. And then we get started registering new gardeners as well. So things are pretty busy throughout the year, actually. Right now, also a lot of grant writing, trying to figure out funding and programming for the next season.
How, staying with community gardening for a moment, we'll bring the kids back in a minute,
okay.
But how many people participate in community gardening in Brown County?
Yes, so we have 10 gardens throughout the county, and we have 308 garden plots, and among those, we have 200 gardening families, so some have more than one plot, just depending on the family.
And is that something that's been growing over the years?
It has. So the program started in 1996, and it started really small, just one site with 12 garden plots,
wow.
And now we've expanded to the 10 sites, so it's really grown, and we've really seen an increase in interest in gardening in recent years, and still... every year we ask our gardeners, is this a good amount of space or do you need more space to garden? And every year they ask for more. So we're still growing and looking to grow into the future.
And do you see a lot of kids participating with their families in these?
Yes, it's a wonderful activity. We actually ask all of our gardeners, do you spend more time with your family because you garden? We do a survey at the end of the season. And one of the things that they always come back and say is, yes, this was a great experience with our kids to get to spend time all together.
And do you do other partnerships at the community garden like this one we've been talking about with the Boys and Girls Club?
Yes, we also partner with the City of Green Bay. We do some children's education. So when we started the Teen Farmers Market program, that was kind of to fill a gap that we realized that we didn't have any programming for older kids. But we do programming with younger kids with the City of Green Bay. And then also we partner with New Leaf Foods to do a Green Bay Garden Blitz program. And so that's another way to increase gardening in the area. So we build 4 feet by 8 feet raised garden beds and then sell them and distribute them with volunteers throughout the community over the course of one weekend in May.
Oh, so people aren't just growing for themselves. They're starting to distribute food beyond that?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
The garden beds. I'm sorry, you were saying you sell.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So people can purchase them for their own homes or organizations. We're working on selling those right now so people can buy those, and then we install them over the course of that one weekend so they have a space to grow their own food.
Now, getting back to the program with the kids, coming back, as you said, next year, do you see this actually working for the goal intended, to getting these kids these job skills and meeting those needs that you mentioned in that economic evaluation from a few years back?
I really think so. I mean, there's so much research to show that hands-on experience is really important. And so they're getting the experience that they wouldn't have otherwise, talking with customers, planning, getting to, kind of follow a project from start to finish. So I think that they'll really be able to apply that later on in life.
Now, my gut guess would be that you're a pretty handy gardener yourself. Is that fair to say?
I've been gardening since I was a kid, yeah.
Okay. And is it fun for you being able to work with kids? As you said, some of them, this is first-time gardening, teaching them from the ground up, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. No, it's really fun to get to see their first experience being in the garden. Sometimes they have such a wide range of growing experiences. Some haven't ever gardened before and, you know, don't know that a cucumber grows in a certain way or that a beet grows under the ground, things like that. So it's really fun to get to see their first growing experience.
And at the end result, are the kids trying maybe some vegetables they've never tried or wanted to try before?
Absolutely. No, there's a lot of research out there, and we've just seen firsthand experience that when kids grow their own food, they're definitely more willing to try it and then eat it in the long run.
And if your colleagues around the state are thinking, hey, this is a good idea, how would you recommend they get started on stealing the idea or borrowing, I guess we could say?
Yes. No, I'd be happy to talk with anyone through the Brown County. You know, I actually kind of borrowed the idea from Iron County. They have a similar program up there as well, slightly different with younger kids a bit, but we, you know, would be happy to have it spread throughout the state. So,
Margaret, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We've been talking to Margaret Franchino, Community Garden Coordinator for University of Wisconsin Extension in Brown County, talking about a youth farmers market program there aimed at teaching job and business skills to local youth. Coming up after the news, we talk to a chef about all the different ways you can cook eggs. He's got advice from doing some of the basic stuff just right. You know, it's not as easy as you think to really make a great hard-boiled egg. And he's got some jazzy new ways. How about chorizo on deviled eggs? That and more coming up on Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin lawmakers need to redraw voting boundaries after a court order issued today. We'll hear more in our weekly roundup of Wisconsin news. First, it's Food Friday, and we're going to take a look at nature's ultimate convenience food, eggs. Whether you like to fry, poach, scramble, or boil yours, our guest has advice and some new recipes to share. Lazarus Lynch is with us now. He's also known as the son of a Southern chef. He's an entertainment chef from Queens, New York, who focuses on Southern cooking. Lazarus, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Such a pleasure to be back.
You know, eggs are one of those foods we just kind of take for granted. Make the case for a little more respect for the humble egg.
Yes, you know, the humble egg is often one that is discriminated, but as many chefs know, and even enthusiast home cooks, eggs play a fundamental role in the cooking process. You know, with eggs, you can do so many things. It's used as a thickener in sauces. We know it as an emulsifier in things like mayonnaise, and it also just adds body to many desserts that we love, such as cake and souffles. So there are a number of ways that you can use eggs in the kitchen, and I think it deserves a whole lot more respect than what it gets today.
You've spent a lot of time, I understand, working with eggs in the past when you were an intern on the Food Network. There was a daily egg assignment or something like that?
You can call it that, Rob. That's a very nice way of putting it. But I interned at the Food Network when I was in high school. This is back in 2011. Not quite dating myself. I'm still fairly young. And my boss loved eggs, boiled eggs in the morning, and I would get there, 30 minutes before everyone else would. So she said, could you boil some eggs? And it was the scariest thing in my life because, let's face it, we're working at the Food Network. I'm an intern from high school. And, I thought, if I mess up these eggs, I'm not going to live it down. So I had to learn. And thank God I was taught how to do it. And every single day, it was clockwork, egg work, perfection. I executed perfectly hard-boiled eggs. And I'm happy to share those tips with some viewers, listeners today.
Let's do that now. We've got links, by the way, to how to hard-boil an egg or soft-boil an egg, for that matter, and some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. Lazarus, I have boiled eggs. They usually come out pretty good. But what is the secret to getting them right, even for a fussy Food Network manager?
So, eggs, boiled eggs specifically, it's interesting. The name denotes that you boil the eggs, but that's actually not true. And I think that's a mistake that many inexperienced cooks with eggs make. So what you want to do is you want to start out with, eggs and submerge them in a pot filled with cold water. I like to bring the water just up to a boil. I said don't boil it, but you bring it up just to a boil and you shut it off immediately. You cover it with a lid, and depending on how cooked you want the yolk, you let it stand. So for the average large egg, you want to cover it and keep it covered for about 12 minutes. For medium egg, you want to go 9 minutes. For an extra large egg, you want to go 15 minutes. And you will always get a perfectly cooked hard-boiled egg.
Yeah, I think I picture myself making hard-boiled eggs. I'm pretty sure it's sitting there in a pot of boiling water for a period of time. What goes wrong? How does that mess it up? Because, it's hard to peel, I think, when I do it that way. Is that it?
Well, it certainly does get harder to peel, and the peeling process actually has more to do with the freshness of the egg more than anything else. But, what's interesting is there's a reaction that happens inside of the yolk, which is where the iron is, and the sulfur, which is in the whites, has a negative reaction causing this greenish color that comes around the yolk. And, my mother would make eggs. I love you, Mom, but she would oftentimes overcook the egg, and you would get this really nasty, eggy smell, as I'm sure many people know what I'm talking about, as well as that greenish outer layer. So to avoid that, and also to keep really tender yolks, you don't want to overcook it, you don't want to boil it or cook it for too long.
We are cooking eggs with Lazarus Lynch. He's a chef in Queens, New York, a.k.a. son of a Southern chef. Well, we hit boiling basics, Lazarus. Let's go to scrambled. And I've got four people in my household. We all like our scrambled eggs a little different. One kid says, Dad, I like them browner. You did it wrong. Some more omelety. What is your vision of a perfect scrambled egg?
Well, a perfect scrambled egg for me, it goes back to another job I held where it was my job to make the scrambled eggs in the morning. And the first thing I was asked to do was cook scrambled eggs for my boss before she hired me. I'm happy to say I passed the test. The key to perfectly scrambled eggs is using a gentle cooking temperature. I think oftentimes many people, including myself in the past before I learned how to do it right, use high heat. And what that does is it creates a burnt outer texture and a rubbery texture in the scrambled eggs. So I like to whisk some eggs in a bowl. I season them first. I think salt adds a little bit more tenderness to the egg. I don't use cream. I don't use water. I think when you do it right, you don't need to add them. But I would say if you wanted to stretch the amount of eggs, you can totally use a liquid. And then I just use a nonstick pan or a cast iron skillet over medium or low heat, a little bit of butter, and I scramble very gently. I'm constantly moving the eggs in the pan, and I take them off the heat right before they're set. You want to make sure that they're a little bit wet, and that's actually going to create a really creamy egg, because what will happen is it will carry over cooking. Once you put it on a plate, it will still cook about 10 degrees or so. So I take it off a little bit early, and you have perfectly scrambled eggs.
So with both boiling and scrambling, an easy mistake to make is too hot for too long.
Too hot for too long. It's that ambitious, eagerness of a chef or a cook who just wants to keep touching things. And the key to cooking is to take your time, let it do its thing, don't mess around too much, and low and slow.
All right. Those are a couple of the basics. Now, you gave us some recipes. This next one, it's on the Central Time Facebook page. And Lazarus, sometimes for Food Friday, I look at a recipe and I think, why am I not eating that right now? And this is one of those. you provided us, there's a video for this too, chorizo deviled eggs. These look fantastic. Mm. Talk us through this.
This chorizo deviled egg, you know, I'm from New York City, but my father, who's from the South, loved making a deviled egg. And really, all a deviled egg means is something that's really spicy or heavily spiced. It's not actually possessed by any sort of egg demon, right?
Because I was wondering, yeah.
Yeah, as so many are. So with the deviled egg, you know, I take chorizo, which is a Spanish sausage, and I cook the sausage. I remove it from the casings, and I cook it down, and I hard boil the eggs. And then I add a little bit of Dijon mustard in the egg yolks. I break it down, some homemade mayonnaise, or it's just some really good quality store-bought mayonnaise. I season it up very nicely with some salt, pepper, paprika, and it's just perfect. And you stuff that in the egg, and you top it with that chorizo and that lovely red oil from the chorizo that's a little bit salty and a little bit spicy, just oozes down the egg yolk or the egg whites. And it's just really, really a festive way to create some deviled eggs. I love that recipe.
I like deviled eggs. I've never made them. I think of them as complicated. Michelle here at the board says, no, she's shaking her head. They're easy. She thinks I'm dumb for thinking they're hard to make. But I imagine you got to putting these out at a party, these deviled eggs with the chorizo on top. What kind of reaction do you get from those?
Well, first of all, people are like, oh, my goodness, what is that red stuff on top of my deviled eggs, right? So it looks extra wicked, I'd say. The other reaction you get is when people taste it, they get this really interesting balance of creamy from the egg yolks, which have been really nicely treated in that boiling water. They get a creaminess and they get a really crunchy texture of the chorizo. It's spicy. It's a little bit mustardy from the mustard. I also love to throw in some horseradish sometimes to add a little bit of extra flavor. So it's a really nice bite. It's not overwhelming. And it's in the South, that's the way people greet each other, is with a deviled egg.
I could see these, at a social gathering for sure. But, you know, these could make a real good centerpiece of a meal. What kind of things would you want to see served alongside these chorizo deviled eggs?
Well, I think you have the eggs. You know, if you're doing a small party, I think, you know, obviously cheese and crackers are excellent. They go very well together. I also like to do just some breadsticks. You know, I take some phyllo dough, or I'll take some puff pastry dough. I'll fill it with a little bit of cheese. I'll use that egg to brush the outside of the pastry, and I'll twist them, throw them into a hot oven at about 375 degrees. And there you have it again. You have a delicious side. Eggs were used as a glaze, which is, you know, which eggs are used for a lot in baking. It makes a really great centerpiece with the deviled eggs.
That recipe, again, up on the Central Time Facebook page, along with some others from Lazarus. Let's talk omelets now. If I'm going to make a meal, a quick meal that's centered around eggs, an egg dinner, I'm going to go for an omelet. And usually mine come out pretty good. What are your tips to make a really good omelet?
Really good omelet is, I think you've got to have good ingredients inside of it. And as always with cooking eggs, you want to use fresh eggs. Fresh eggs just taste better. I start with room temperature eggs. So I'll take my eggs out of the fridge maybe about 15 minutes before I start to cook them, just because they react better to the heat once they hit the hot pan. Or if I don't have that time, I soak the eggs in just some hot water for about a minute and I get them room temperature. And I think you have to have really good filling. So what I do is I start to scramble the eggs just as I would a scramble egg, and I take it off the heat. Take the pan off the heat. I spread with a spatula. I love using a rubber spatula. Spread the remaining wet egg throughout the remainder of the pan, and then I fill it with my mushrooms that I've cooked, or I'll use some bacon and some peppers and some tomatoes, a little bit of cheese, and I fold it in half, and then I just flip it onto a plate. It's a really, really easy thing to do. French omelets are a little bit different. You know, you have to really give it lower heat, more control, but a basic American omelet, Western omelet, is so easy to make.
And do you, again, not put in some milk? Some people want to put milk in their omelets.
Yeah, I pretty much have that, you know, standard rule. There are times where I do put liquid inside of the eggs, but that's usually if I'm really low on eggs and I need to stretch it for a hungry family, so I'll do that. But, you know, normally people add liquid because they think this is going to, you know, make the eggs creamier. But the truth is, it actually just creates separation between the egg whites, the egg yolks, and the liquid that you add. So what I like to do is just leave it out and you know, and just keep it on a low temperature, and you'll have the best, creamiest eggs you can imagine.
I'm talking to Lazarus Lynch. He's an entertainment chef who's talking to us about all the different things you can do with eggs. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us how you like to cook and or eat your eggs, what your favorite egg-related recipes are. Do you have your own spin on classics like deviled eggs or omelets? Do you have any secret egg-making tips to share? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Find some recipes from Lazarus there. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Maybe hear from you. Coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm picking up our conversation now with Lazarus Lynch, also known as the son of a Southern chef. He has a lot of advice about cooking with eggs, the basics, and some fancier recipes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your favorite recipe involving eggs. Do you eat eggs for meals? Other than breakfast, do you have ways of cooking eggs that you try to make them healthier, maybe a little different than things you've seen elsewhere? Or do you have a question for Lazarus? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post and find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. Lazarus, let's get to another recipe you sent us. Let's try the, you mentioned eggs, of course, great in desserts. Coconut key lime bars. Tell us about that.
Those coconut key lime bars, I first made them for a girlfriend of mine back in college, and needless to say, she fell in love with me. it's one of those desserts that it's basically a custard, and eggs obviously are really fundamental in a custard. It's all about temperature. The difference with this is that you don't cook it as a normal custard on the stove. You actually just combine the egg yolks with some condensed milk and some sugar and, of course, your limes or key limes, and it's a really easy dessert to make. And what you do is once you mix that batter together, get it a little bit airy, you put that into a graham cracker crust, and you bake it very gently in the oven. I like to use a bain-marie, which is basically a larger dish that you fill with water, boiling water, halfway up the sides of the dish. And what that will do is create a nice, even cooking throughout the custard, very traditional way for cooking custards. And that's, you know, that's one of the many ways that you can use eggs in a dessert.
That sounds great. Again, we have that up at the Central Time Facebook page. Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Edgar is with us in West Allis. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the hard-boiled eggs. But one really helpful thing that I've learned is to put the eggs, after they come off the boiling water, into ice water to sort of shock them and preserve the freshness of the egg.
Edgar, thanks. Is that something that works, Lazarus?
Absolutely. You know, I got so caught up in the cooking process, and you have to cool the egg quite immediately, actually. And just as Edgar said so eloquently, you put it into, you know, ice water or really cold water. And as soon as that happens, you want to make sure that the egg is very cool before you take it and crack it. What I like to do is I crack the egg around all sides and I roll it between the palms of my hands just to loosen the skin, and it will come, or loosen the peel, and it will come, the shell, and it'll come right off.
And if you don't put in that ice wash, I imagine it's going to kind of keep cooking. It's going to stay really hot for a while.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And an overcooked egg is not a tasty egg.
Edgar, thanks a lot for that. We'll go next to Ed in West Harlan. Ed, hi.
Hi, McFarland, actually.
Oh, McFarland. Our producer misheard you, I think. I didn't think I'd heard of West Harlan. McFarland, I've heard of. What did you want to bring up, Ed?
So the hard-boiling egg technique. Should you leave some room in the pot of boiling water? Can you, you know, fit as many as you can in there? Does that matter?
Great question. You know, I like to fill the pot completely with eggs, as many eggs as it can hold. You know, if you're using like a 4-quart, 6-quart pot, you know, you can probably fit anywhere from, you know, 6 to 8 eggs in there, probably even more. And you want to make sure that the water comes like right above, maybe an inch above the eggs. It's really important that the eggs are completely submerged. But overlapping them, honestly, it means that the cooking process won't be even. I will tell you, though, in a restaurant where I used to work, we had to boil eggs and we fit as many as can in that pot. But I will tell you, it took a really, really good chef to know how to peel those eggs perfectly so that they wouldn't fall apart because they were cooked at so many different times and temperatures.
Ed, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Christine in Milwaukee. Christine, hi.
Hi there. I'm loving your egg show. I just wanted to share two things. First, we just started with our own chickens this year. And so we're having our own fresh eggs every day, and which is actually pretty amazing. And then part two is eggs aren't just for breakfast in our family. We do an egg burrito for dinner, and we take, you know, those little mini peppers you can buy that are multicolored, and we chop those up with an onion, and then we like it spicy, so we'll do a jalapeno. And then some garlic and salt and pepper. And then we use a Mexican spice. It says pico de gallo on the little can. It's like a red spice. It's pretty spicy. We sprinkle that in there, cook it with our eggs, scramble them up, and put them in our burrito, and that's dinner.
Christine, thanks a lot for that. And Lazarus, that's something I love too, eggs scrambled, maybe with stuff in them, but then salsa, cheese, and a tortilla, and eggs are less boring all of a sudden.
Absolutely. I'm getting so hungry. I think I'm going to have to go over their house for dinner tonight.
Any advice for jazzing that up for Christine? Any other permutations she might want to try on that egg burrito?
Well, you know, I love throwing sausage or, you know, some kind of meat inside of the egg burrito. One of the things that I love to do is also use some sun-dried tomatoes, adding some goat cheese maybe to that. Ooh. To give it a little bit of tang. I think it really brings out the flavor in some eggs. You know, that burrito sounds amazing, though. I probably wouldn't mess with it.
Christine, thanks a lot for sharing that. Lazarus Lynch is with us, a.k.a. the son of a Southern chef. He's got tons of advice on cooking with eggs. You can join in still at 800-642-1234. Our next caller is Rob, calling from La Crosse. Rob, hi.
Hi, guys. Also loving the show. And my wife and I actually had egg burritos last night, so that's funny.
Nice.
So I kind of have two questions for you. First one, whenever I cook eggs, I always end up with a lot of egg, like, sticking to the pan, whether I use Teflon or just a, you know, regular metal pan. I'm guessing it's, you know, too hot and trying to cook them too fast or whatever. So also second question is, what is like a really good pan? We try and stay away from Teflon, of course, but what's a good pan?
Great, Rob. Thanks a lot for the call. So, probably both questions could be answered at once. Lazarus, why are his eggs sticking to his pan? What's the best kind of pan to scramble some eggs in?
You know, I think it's a combination of using a fat and using a nonstick pan. So I have, you know, nonstick pans at my house, and you know, I'm not big on naming brands, but I will tell you that a really good nonstick pan will last you a lifetime, and as long as you store it properly and wash it properly, it will work great. But I like to use a little bit of oil or a little bit of butter in the pan. A mistake that people make a lot of the times is they put eggs into a cold pan, or they put anything into a cold pan, and so the oil hasn't had time to get into the pores of the pan. So it's important that your oil or your fat gets hot before you actually add your ingredients.
Thanks a lot for the call, Rob. Hope that will help you out. I don't know if we have time for another caller, but one caller on our line wanted to bring up quiche. One question I have about quiche, Lazarus, I'll make it. I love it, but I end up with like this tough bit on the top, and I wonder if that's because I mix milk in. You were mentioning earlier that milk separates out the white and the yolk. Could that be what's giving this like tough, like almost rubbery texture in little spots?
You know, the great question. You know, there's quiches, frittatas, omelets. The omelet and the frittata, of course, you cook in the oven. But, you know, I think cream is totally appropriate in a quiche. What it does, it helps to actually create more like a custard inside of the pastry. I would encourage you to maybe turn your oven down a little bit, or take the eggs out just a little bit under. You know, don't allow it to cook all the way through. Just take it out a little bit under, maybe a minute or so than you would normally, and allow the eggs to sort of remain cooking you know, at room temperature. And we make quiche all the time in my family. And I think that's the key to it, is you want to take it out when it's a little bit on the underside.
Want to touch briefly, we're just about out of time, Southern bourbon eggnog. You've given us a recipe for that. To tell us just a bit about that.
Yeah, that's a, you know, eggnog in my house is very popular around Christmas, but the truth is we want it all year round, right? We love eggnog. What makes it, in my opinion, what makes it a little bit more interesting is when we add a little bit of bourbon. So, you know, we cook the recipe just as it's on the website and add a little bourbon at the end. We stir it in and it's perfect. You know, the key to cooking a great eggnog, though, is not to add too hot of milk to the egg yolks, because you'll get curdled egg and that's not good. So.
That's not something I'd want to drink, I don't think. But that, for the curdled part, I mean, this sounds
really
good,
again.
Lazarus, thank you so much. It's always fun to talk to you.
Same to you, Rob. Thank you.
That's Lazarus Lynch, also known as the son of a Southern chef. He's an entertainment chef from Queens, New York. He focuses on Southern style or Southern-inspired cooking. He's with us today to talk about cooking with eggs, getting a lot of the basics there, and some fun recipes. You can find some recipes now on the Central Time Facebook page, the chorizo deviled eggs, that eggnog we were just hearing about, the coconut key lime bars. A couple more, and a couple of the basics. How to boil an egg is up there as well. That's on the Central Time Facebook page. If you play word games, Scrabble, maybe in person, or Words with Friends online, it's possible you get frustrated sometimes when your favorite slang word of yours isn't recognized as a valid word. Well, if that's the case, the rapper Ludacris has a solution. A new version of his wordplay app, Slang and Friends, came out today. From what I can tell, it looks like Words with Friends, which looks a lot like Scrabble. But the twist, it accepts lots of slang words, and you can enter your own slang words for future recognition. So you could end up with more recent slang like bae, not a lot of points there, old school words like hep, or British slang like gobsmacked, you name it. Ludacris explains the goal. He says, in a time when so much of the world is divided, technology has the opportunity to bring us together. Slang and Friends encourages users to connect, be friendly, and identify what they have in common through language. Also a chance for different generations to learn about each other's unique forms of communication. Maybe bridge some generation gaps. This could help me because I have an old slang I always want to use when I've got that Z. I can always spell zoot, like zoot suit, and it never takes it. I assume that's slang, so maybe I have to switch from Words with Friends to Slang and Friends. Maybe buy that zoot suit I've had my eye on for so long. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.